Welcome to Byte Action Podcast. For those who don't know, Byte Action Podcast is on a mission to bring you raw and filtered journeys of experienced and influential people in video games and creative tech industries. If you want to understand how games are made, who are the creators behind your everyday entertainment, and what it takes to build successful companies, games, and products, then you should give this a listen. Cool. So how are you? How's your week been so far? Tell me.
Yeah, very good. Thanks. Just a bit busy going. Obviously, we've got the Easter weekend coming up, so just looking forward to that. But yeah, we're just lots of busy project work. GDC's just been, so, you know, there's been some involvement on the company side from that. And just working towards kind of constant deadlines, pretty much. Not much new to report other than another typical day in dev, really.
Okay. Did you go to GDC at all or no?
Unfortunately not, no. So, some people in the company did, and I was contributing towards some stuff, you know, related to that. But no, I didn't get to go in person.
Cool. I mean, just to start with, maybe with this one, I mean, there's several things that I want to kind of to talk to you about. I think you have a lot of interesting experiences that I wanted to touch upon. And, you know, we can definitely talk about various projects and games you worked on and studios you were a part of. But maybe just to start with, from my side, it'd be interesting to learn, you know, your background and you know, where this kind of passion and interest in game design started. Did it start in your childhood? Did you sort of decide just later on in your career that you want to do game design and kind of work in games in general? Like, how did the whole kind of interest in games in general start with you?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think I started in terms of playing games, it was kind of the Master System era, Master System 2, which was kind of the early 90s. So I was pretty young at the time, but that was kind of the 8-bit generation. And even playing some games then, I never used to think, oh, one day this will be a career, you know, playing Alex Kidd or Enduro Racer or Black Belt or something. Mm-hmm. At that point, I used to just think games were kind of magic. You know, you just switch on the console and stuff just appears on the TV. I didn't necessarily think that there was artists and kind of programmers and things like that putting this together. I just thought this magical kind of, you know, device just appeared and showed some cool stuff on the screen. And it's only when you start to see things like Steven Spielberg's name up front on Jurassic Park and, oh, hey, it's that guy who also did E.T. and, you know, a bunch of other films. That's when you start to realize that there's kind of like, you know, there's people behind the kind of curtain. And certainly in kind of like the early 90s, unless you completed very difficult games, you wouldn't necessarily see the credits. So it's only kind of later on in my career, certain games I used to follow. I used to pick up some cheap N64 games, things like Body Harvest, Space Station, Silicon Valley, the kind of hidden gems on the platform. They just so happened to be made by DMA Design, who are now these days kind of Rockstar North, or what became kind of Rockstar North.
Okay.
And by the time the PS2 era come round, you've got GTA 3 comes out. And I was always thinking at that time, you know, if I could ever work on a game or if I had an idea for a game, it would be exactly kind of GTA 3. But the kind of the slightly tedious link there is, I was well aware of that studio and a bunch of people in those kind of games because I'd played the prior, you know, Hidden Gems on the N64. And also, I was really into kind of, you know, the mafia films, you know, things like The Godfather and Goodfellas. It's almost kind of all coalesces. You've got designers, artists, people's names are kind of recognized, but then also you've got these high profile kind of celebrities. Mm-hmm. And also, I'm based in the northeast of the UK, and Edinburgh's, you know, a couple of hours kind of train ride away from me, and that's where Rockstar North is kind of based. So unfortunately, I've never worked for Rockstar up until this point, but that kind of idea of, you know, slowly but surely discovering that there's people behind the game. And then my local university and the local area, we also had a fruitful kind of area, almost like a mini Silicon Valley for X kind of game developers. Okay. And the university on my doorstep basically was doing a game design degree. So the combination of those kind of things, as well as magazines that I was reading about, you know, how to get into the industry. I went to a college course, which was a generalist kind of design course. All of this kind of stuff coalesced into, you know, there's potentially a career into games and then eventually into design specifically.
Okay, got you. And what was your first role in games? How did you end up applying and what was the first studio that you had an opportunity to work on? What was the first project?
Yeah, so I first joined the industry 2010, and this was for Ubisoft Reflections. So again, they're based in the Northeast. You know, historically, Reflections is not a Ubisoft studio, but became a Ubisoft studio shortly before I kind of joined. And that was working on the Driver San Francisco game, which was, I think, maybe the fourth or fifth entry of the franchise at that point. And I was brought on as a junior game designer. So I was basically getting my feet wet in all different aspects of the game, not necessarily one particular area. So there's kind of many challenges in the game. I was involved with some of those, some of the driving mechanics. I was involved with that kind of stuff. Placement of kind of traffic and, you know, accidents around the city to basically bring life to the world. There's kind of a crash system in the game, a bit like in the Burnout games when you drive at high speed and then crash and then you get slow-mo kind of camera. We were doing something similar to that. So yeah, it was almost like a pick and mix of different things I was doing. And I got that role because at the end of my university, I was part of a Dragon's Den kind of scenario where the person on the other side of the table was reviewing some pitches, and the winning pitch would effectively get an internship at Ubisoft. And I was that winning pitch. So that was basically my first role straight out university.
That's into awesome.
A junior game design position.
Yeah. That's awesome. Did you do it? Did you do the pitch with other people, or was it just you?
Yeah, so there was just me on my own, but on the other side of the table, there was four people. So much like the kind of Dragon's Den show, I think there was somebody from Eidos at the time. So we're talking kind of 15 years ago. So somebody from Eidos, somebody from Ubisoft, who basically, that was the person who hired me. Somebody from the team that made Darwinia. And I think there was somebody else who was maybe some kind of industry investor, you know, looking for like the next big kind of project. Yeah, and those were on the other side of the table. You know, some kind of harsher comments from some people, some kind of friendly comments from other people, but ultimately it led to what was my first role in games.
Oh, that's pretty cool. I mean, whenever I talk to people, I'm always curious to hear the journeys that people had. And, you know, some of these journeys are very interesting and very different. You know, some people go through this path of going into university, applying for positions and kind of, you know, getting their first role or getting an internship. Others,
yeah,
you know, take like a very different path and somehow they end up in the industry. Do you know if these sort of pitches, they're still happening? Sort of like the Dragon's Den type selection process for people who want to enter the industry? And have you been maybe one of those people now on the other end as well?
Yeah, kind of yes or no, actually. It's interesting you mentioned that because there's definitely companies that are doing graduate schemes. And, you know, that's kind of the means to the end, so, you know, to hire kind of the best talent. I don't necessarily know if that's done in the format of, you know, create a pitch and then show us your pitch and then we may or may not kind of hire you. Typically, mm-hmm. These days, I think it would be more of a portfolio kind of review. And I think at that time, I was fortunate in that I, you know, kind of only had to do a presentation. But that was before Unreal Engine was kind of synonymous with, you know, boots on the ground, kind of, you know, jump in the engine and create a prototype. At that time, that wasn't really feasible, or at least if it was, you know, you didn't have the support like you would necessarily have these kind of days. But in terms of being on the other side of the table, I've definitely been in terms of the, you know, the interviewing, kind of reviewing portfolios kind of process, but I've not necessarily been back to university. Sure. And, you know, sat on the other side of the table, you know, like I experienced.
Sure. What do you look for when people apply for positions? I mean, obviously, you've been in leadership roles for a while now. So, you know, when you are reviewing applications, when you are reviewing portfolios that people send to, or even when you're interviewing people, kind of what are the important things for you to consider? What are you looking for from the applicants?
Yeah, that's a great question, actually. So, first and foremost, probably the way that somebody thinks. So certainly in terms of a design role, it's more about you're going to get a problem thrown at you. And there are certain things that are out of your control. So that might be the budget, it might be the platform, it might be the people on the team that you're working with. You know, you might have to solve some kind of problem with the combat system in the game, but you don't have any animators. So it's kind of like, you know, that's the problem. How do you solve that? Or how do you improve the attacks in the game if you don't have animators that kind of with you? Mm-hmm. So throwing those kind of curveballs at people and asking them to kind of, you know, demonstrate a difficult scenario that they had and how they overcome that particular thing, but also what was their approach? And that's the most interesting part for me is how did they solve that particular problem? And, you know, what made them think the way that they kind of thought? So that's definitely one side. And the other side, a lot of the typical answers I tend to hear maybe from that question is, you know, to create a great portfolio and then kind of showcase that kind of stuff. But for me, I quite like people that more than the sum of their parts. So I quite like people that maybe have a little bit of life experience that haven't necessarily or don't necessarily play games 100% of the time. Somebody who's maybe pretty well read, you know, maybe they have some kind of interest in an area that I could kind of learn from, I don't know, history or sport or geography or whatever it may be, you know, there's some kind of background. But then on top of that, you know, there's the passion for kind of games and the technical kind of side of it as well. In general, I would probably prefer somebody who is a jack of all trades that brings some kind of life experience rather than somebody who is solely just an expert kind of game designer, because I think you can teach game design, but you can't teach life experience. So that's the way I would kind of frame it.
Sure. And when you have life experience, I guess that makes you a lot more creative in a position like being a game designer now. So you can reference different things and, you know, you can look at the problem and the situations differently.
Exactly. Yeah. Not everybody's from the same background. So, you know, they approach it kind of differently, but also things like, you know, say customer service, about how you kind of approach people and how you talk to people. You're going to be working with lots of different people from different nations of different nationalities in different disciplines, and kind of getting them all on board with your ideas, or, you know, pushing them towards a certain goal. That's kind of the bread and butter of a designer.
Yeah. It's interesting. You mentioned when you gave examples of backgrounds that people had, you mentioned history, for example. So I presume something like that, especially if you're working on a game based on some kind of a historical era, or, you know, you have to reference a lot of things that perhaps happened in the past, I guess those sort of experiences are quite invaluable. Do you tend to bring in people like consultants from certain fields like history, or I don't know, other fields, when, for example, you're working on a game as a designer, or do you typically research and, you know, interview people yourself, or do you normally bring in some kind of a consultant to kind of help you out with the service? For example, I don't know, when you, let's say you're working on a game that's based on some kind of historical context, let's say World War II or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I've got two examples for this. I think one of them was we worked on a Robin Hood game a few years ago called Hood Outlaws and Legends, PS5, you know, shortly after kind of launch title. And that was set in a medieval-ish kind of time. You know, think of it almost like a Game of Thrones kind of style experience. And we didn't necessarily have a narrative person on the team or somebody dedicated to the story and the lore in the background. But what we did have is somebody who was a writer that had wrote a lot of Robin Hood novels. So they did a lot of the background story for basically some unlocks towards the end of the game. So if you would progress with a certain character, you would unlock a small piece of their backstory. And that person basically wrote those kind of backstories. So that was pretty cool. And then on my side, because I was very involved with like developing the characters, and in this case, it was a Robin Hood style character, things about how, you know, projectiles kind of flew in, you know, medieval times, and how many arrows could somebody kind of carry, and, you know, how loud were the arrows, you know, if you were shooting them in the forest, because it was a PvP kind of game. If you were to shoot somebody with an arrow and they didn't hear it, or they couldn't kind of foresee that kind of coming, we needed to account for what kind of things were historically accurate versus what things would satisfy the gameplay kind of better. So in that case, we ended up adding kind of artificial noise to arrows, for example. It makes them sound more powerful, but also it means that players can actually hear them. And the same is also true on a later game I worked on, Call of Duty Vanguard, where the campaign of that set in World War II was very historically accurate. You know, certainly compared to the multiplayer mode, where they start to, you know, have crazy cosmetics and kind of, you know, attachments and things like that to the weapons. But it was an interesting era because they start to push the boundaries a little bit of, at the end of World War II and shortly before the Cold War, there was notions of experimentation with kind of laser scopes and, you know, reflective kind of sights and, you know, magnified kind of scopes and things like that. And yes, so basically in the campaign of Vanguard, they started to introduce kind of maybe 50s technology in a game that was in the mid kind of 40s. So sometimes you have to kind of push the boundary a little bit just for gameplay kind of purposes. But generally speaking, you know, as long as it's historically accurate and it's good for gameplay, then it's good on both sides.
You specialize in combat design, at least from what I read about you. What's unique about being a combat designer as opposed to being a generalist designer?
Yeah, so generally speaking, combat's definitely one side of it, but I'd probably more describe it as more the moment-to-moment kind of design. So combat is, you know, maybe gameplay, it's maybe melee attacks, you know, weapons, kind of stuff, you know. And there's also kind of the traversal side of that as well, you know, navigation across the world in terms of talking about moment-to-moment. But really, the big difference or the big kind of game changer with this is if you're a moment-to-moment designer, you're working on or you're contributing towards the thing that the player is going to feel, you know, almost every second, if not kind of, you know, minute and, you know, not much longer than that, on a repetitive cycle. And really the goal is to make the mundane feel memorable. You know, that's the big difference is every time you land that hit with a sword, it needs to feel good. Every time you miss with a gun, it needs to feel good because that's what people are going to do most of the time. You know, not everybody gets a headshot 100% of the time. And it's all about thinking of the player experience, trying to keep them in the zone for, you know, the foreseeable, you know, in some cases, you know, 10, 15 minutes kind of play time. It could be a couple of hours in kind of the more involved titles like Call of Duty. When you pick up the pad in Call of Duty, you're going to be sat down and playing that for, you know, the best part of 2 hours. And the pressure is always on the people who are most ingrained with the moment-to-moment design. And it's much the same with, say, a Mario game. The person who, you know, basically is involved or the people involved with Mario are probably the most important people on the entire project because without the character, without the feel of the movements, you know, the satisfaction of the jumps and landing the special kind of transitions for the moves, the whole game kind of falls down. And that's much the case with, you know, combat design, with traversal design and anything else that's related to the, you know, the character moment to moment, including kind of vehicles and things like that as well.
Sure. What were the games that, in your opinion, that you recently maybe played had the best combat design, maybe not including the games that you worked on yourself?
Yeah, one that I always go back to, and I compare this even, you know, modern games here, say like a Helldivers, is a Metal Gear Solid 5. At this point, we're chatting right now. That game is probably almost 9 years old at this point. And it's surprising to me that in the 9 years I've played games since, I could probably count on one hand how many games I think are comparable to that experience at the high end of kind of AAA, just in the sense of the transitions between the state of the character, what we'd call like animation coverage and, you know, how seamless it feels to go from kind of sprint to slides to crouch, you know, and pulling the weapon out, putting the weapon away. It really feels like you're playing as a super soldier. And obviously that's exactly what you are. You're a, you know, part bionic, you know, kind of character. And I think it's in an open world kind of sense, it basically puts a lot of pressure on the character needs to be able to overcome different terrain. There could be enemies that you know, you climb over a hill and all of a sudden they're in front of you. And the game feels like it's set up to basically be as, you know, dynamic and as fluid and as adaptable as is needed, as if you were a survivor in that kind of, you know, war-torn world. And that's not to say it hasn't been bettered since. It's just that I think it sets a very high bar for the industry. And as I said, in the past 9 years, the Last of Us 2 is excellent in terms of its kind of animation fidelity. And maybe The Division as well is a really good one in terms of, you know, the progression from the first game to the second game in terms of the gunplay. But definitely Metal Gear Solid 5 is a very high bar.
As a game designer, do you have to play a lot of games, and is it part of your job? And like, what do you play now? And I guess how you play games as well. That's the question. I mean, do you actually get to enjoy them, or do you really look at them as, you know, and understanding how they made more than kind of losing yourself in the moment?
This is kind of a tricky question. So it's much like I said, the previous kind of answer, it's a bit of everything in the sense that there is games that I look at for the purpose of work. For example, you know, maybe it's a similar game or it's a similar project, or going back to the problems we mentioned earlier, most third-person shooters have common problems that they need to solve. And then the question is, how do you solve them? And when you start looking at how, you know, Tomb Raider solved it versus The Last of Us versus, you know, Helldivers, there isn't necessarily one right solution for something, but it might be the right solution for that particular experience. You know, it might be an open world game versus a linear game. You might have a different kind of a route that you take with how you handle shooting round corners, for example, because on a third-person game, the camera's not necessarily looking where the character's looking. So that's one side of it. The other side of it is I don't necessarily play the same games that I work on. You know, earlier in my career, I worked on multiple driving games at a time where I probably didn't play driving games in my own time, you know, in terms of what my kind of interests were. So sometimes that stuff lines up and sometimes it doesn't. And then just in terms of the enjoyment factor, I remember playing Horizon Forbidden West that came out a couple of years ago. Okay. And for the first 45 minutes of that game in the initial area, I basically took the character and stress tested everything about that character, you know, run forwards, run backwards, run into the water, run out the water, you know, jump on the ground, transition off the ground, you know, pull out the bow, put away the bow, you know, do you get wet when you walk in water? What happens if you run into a wall? And there is a couple of, especially high profile games, I will literally do that and make a, you know, using a PlayStation function or, you know, recording on Steam or something. I'll record, you know, just footage of the game and just have a review it afterwards. But generally speaking, aside from that, what I'm looking for is I'm looking for a game that I can just enjoy and only at the point where I need to start reviewing it, or if the game pushes me out the experience is the time I start to critique it. You know, if I missed a headshot, for example, with a gun that was lined up with somebody in the center of the screen, I would put the pad down at that point and try to figure out, you know, what happened, or you know, why was the game not calibrated well enough to allow me to get that headshot?
Sure, I get that. What separates a good game designer from a great or an average? So what separates a great game designer from an average game designer? Basically, that's the question. So, you know, in your opinion, what do you need to have as a game designer as opposed in terms of like quality and experience and maybe even technical skills if you really want to make it in the field?
Yeah, this is a great question. If in short, I would say one thing, a great designer takes things away, whereas an average designer adds. So if I give an example, when you first get a job in the industry, and especially if you're kind of a junior and intermediate, you're learning things, you've maybe got some ideas, you kind of, you know, you're full of beans because you've just got your first job in games and that mm-hmm. kind of thing. You've got a lot to give, you know, hey, why can't we do this with the weapons? Hey, why doesn't the character have a double jump? Hey, why don't we do, you know, X, Y, and Z, whatever it may be. But from a AAA development point of view, to go that kind of route or to bring those kind of ideas to life is expensive. And by the time that you get to a kind of a senior or more of a principal kind of role, which is where I'm in at the moment, firstly, you have the experience of kind of what works and what doesn't work, you know, more appropriately. But also, you start to look at the game as what parts of the game are not working as well as they could do. And if I take something away, it means that something else will start to shine. And that might be, you know, maybe it's a weapon in the game. For example, there's a weapon that is really fun. It's really powerful. It really, you know, everybody loves it. But that weapon is one of 12, and it's the only weapon that people use in the entire game. Therefore, we've created 11 of the weapons that people are not using. They were very expensive to make. How can we kind of showcase them a bit better? We could either, you know, improve them somehow, you know, with the what we call signs and feedback, you know, the haptics, the visuals, you know, the gunplay, the sound of it, wherever. Or it could be we could maybe take this weapon out of rotation, or we could, you know, dampen it down a little bit, take what we've already got and pull something out of the game. And generally speaking, you know, those are the best games are the ones that basically, it's almost like trimming the fat off kind of the meat. It's basically you've got this great kind of thing and you're trying to, you know, just trim the edges. And I think great designers can not only identify what those things are, but also make the harsh decision of, hey, I know we've spent 6 months on this thing, but I actually think we should remove it from the game for X, Y, and Z reason. And then when you do that, eventually you get some kind of resistance against it. So again, there's a resilience kind of aspect to that as well. But the game will almost always be better for it. But that's probably the main one. Technical skills, I don't rate as much as somebody's ability to think from a personal point of view. But I certainly, you know, you can learn software is what I mean by that. And it's the same, like I said earlier. Sure. You can learn the job, but you can't necessarily learn the life experience or the mentality.
It's interesting you gave weapons as a reference. I've just started to think about the, for example, the first person shooter games that I play. And in each game, I would probably choose one, maximum two weapons that I play with. And, you know, sometimes in certain games, there's like an abundance of weapons. But yeah, you know, as a player, you kind of just choose, you know, one, two, I don't know, maybe maximum three. So it's interesting. Obviously, you know, you guys make games and you see the stats of what games people tend to, or what weapons, for example, people tend to use. It must be quite interesting to see. And then obviously after that, you can make informed decisions of what needs to be changed or what needs to be improved.
yeah, exactly. And a lot of that stuff, normally people refer to it as, you know, pick rate. So pick rate for fighting games, for characters, pick rate for weapons, pick rate for characters in Overwatch, for example. And, you know, the solution I mentioned earlier is not necessarily to just take an Overwatch character or to take a weapon and just literally pull it out the game. It's the broader goal of, we've created a lot of this content. How can we really showcase it to the player? Because in your case, like you mentioned there, and for many players, there might be a lot of weapons because there's a certain play style that caters for that. You know, you've all played with the, you know, Battlefield players, and the only thing that they do is sit at the back of the map with a sniper rifle.
Yeah.
And they'll never use the pistol, they'll never use the rocket launchers and things. So that's not to say pull the sniper rifles out the game, but it could be. If you were to introduce smoke grenades, for example, then therefore you kind of take that aspect out of the game and you make it more tactical. But adding the smoke grenade is not necessarily free. You know, it's not a given that it's going to solve the problem. And also it doesn't just, you know, surface, you know, it might actually showcase some other problems like performance issues, because now you've introduced, you know, what is particle effects into the game. But generally speaking, if people can identify something to take away or how you can showcase stuff in a relatively cheap way, that's especially in AAA development, is like gold.
Besides playing games, how else do you build the library of knowledge if you are a game designer? In a sense, like, what other things that you use to learn? Is it books? Are you listening to, I don't know, some kind of podcast? Are you watching some stuff? Do you go to, I don't know, maybe you guys do some kind of presentations in the studio? Like, how do you learn? How do you improve the knowledge that you've got currently?
Yeah, mix of stuff. So probably 5 years ago, podcasts wouldn't have been in that equation because for whatever reason, I was kind of late to the podcast boom, and I've caught up on a whole bunch of stuff now. So definitely that would be my number one, you know, as we kind of speak today, is that I get through probably about 3 hours worth of podcasts today, and that's kind of my morning routine.
Wow. I get up, okay,
yeah, go to the gym. I should say I get through 3 hours worth of podcasts, but they're at 1.5 times speed. So you know, it's, I'm getting through them a bit faster, but at the same time I have a morning routine, and that's one part of it. And I don't necessarily just listen to games podcasts, but you know, recently I've been listening to things of psychology, economics, kind of world history. There's just some general stuff that I'm interested in that may or may not kind of cross over into games, so that's kind of cool. But let's say prior to podcasts, GDC Vault I think is probably the best source available online in terms of pure theory, and also more importantly, it shows you kind of behind the scenes. So you know, we've just had GDC just recently, the conference of people who are working on some of the most high profile games on the planet basically go to unmask the magician. And the fact that that happens once a year on a public kind of scale, and many of those talks are freely available, you know, they're normally put on YouTube, that is kind of gold dust. You know, a lot of people won't get to see behind the doors of the project. And going back to what I said earlier, the types of problems that they faced and how they overcome them, and also explaining why they chose a certain path. Because, you know, you could have two separate games that face the same problem, but they overcome them in slightly separate ways. So that's super cool. And then books. The only downside with books is that if they're wrote in such a way that they feel like they're time bound, they might be pretty good for a certain generation. But then maybe as you move towards, you know, let's say free-to-play games or kind of live service, that book maybe is a little bit out of date in the sense that it doesn't cover what's contemporary in the industry. So generally speaking, I feel like podcasts and GDC Vault are much more contemporary. But in terms of books, I got The Art of Game Design by Jesse Schell and Steve Swink, Game Feel by Steve Swink. Those two books are like essentials for any game designer.
Nice. I'll be interested in checking those out as well later.
Nice.
Yeah, another thing I wanted to ask you about is about being a member and a juror of the BAFTA Academy. So
yeah.
How long have you been doing this? How did you get in there? And I guess what are your kind of responsibilities throughout the year of being a BAFTA Academy member? Like, what do you have to do? Just tell us kind of a little bit more about it.
Yeah, it's cool. I don't get asked this very often, actually. So the first time I ever came across it was, I used to work at Teesside University for a short while.
Uh-huh.
And there was somebody on the staff that said, once a year, they get sent effectively like a carrier bag or a bin bag just full of games because they were involved with BAFTA. And I was like, that's kind of too good to be true. You know, somebody's literally cool. Getting dumped 100 games. Yes. So I had that in my mind at the time. And then when I joined Sumo Digital for Hood Outlaws and Legends, so this was maybe 2018 at this point. So I've been with BAFTA for probably 5 or 6 years kind of at this point. I had a look at what the process was to become a member. It's a paid membership, so they don't necessarily accept everybody. You need a substantial amount of experience before they'll kind of accept you. You know, you couldn't just join BAFTA if it was your first day in the games industry, for example. And the idea is that they're trying to create a credible set of people that have industry experience, not just designers. So they take all disciplines. And also this is separate from the film BAFTAs as well. So this is specifically just for the games kind of side. And what they do is every year they open up the floodgates for people to apply to BAFTA as a member.
Okay.
And they also open up the floodgates for studios to submit their games to BAFTA. And all of the members for that particular year will basically play through as many games as they can within certain categories. Some people are kind of allocated, you know, let's say designers are recommended to play the design or the game development or the best game of the year kind of categories. The animators are recommended to play the animation categories and kind of so on to get enough familiarity with them. And then basically they apply on a kind of a voting process online. This year, there's a couple that have been open to the public. So it's much the same as what the public is able to do. You effectively go to a website and you vote on what were your favorites for the year. And then that's almost like round one.
Mm-hmm.
And round two is from the games that are remaining. So let's say there was 50 games. They get voted down to maybe 10. From those 10, it gets voted down to what would be the final 6 at the ceremony. And that's done as part of a jury. And you get selected for the jury if you put yourself forward for it. And it's a cross-industry kind of set of peers that basically discuss the games in very, very long detail, very lengthy kind of conversations to determine on merit what they think is the best game. But the process is done silently. So, you know, you don't know who the winner is going to be. You don't know what anybody else has kind of voted for.
Sure.
But you're just discussing the merits of kind of each particular game. And then as the BAFTA Awards comes around, which will be in April normally, it's a surprise to everybody about what the winner is. But, you know, it was almost like a secret blind kind of auction, a hidden auction. But yeah, it's great. You get to see all the games kind of up front. You pay for the membership, so a lot of the games kind of come as part of that. But on average, I think I get about 250 games related to that. And you just don't have the time to play through them all.
Oh, my goodness.
So generally speaking, yeah, it's pretty overwhelming. But you know, people tend to go for the high-profile releases. And a lot of people like to shout about indies, you know, because the last few years, sure, BAFTA's really been showcasing that stuff as well.
Sure. Now, do you get them in like a physical form or some of them, or is it mostly digital form?
Yeah, definitely digital. I think by the time I joined BAFTA, there was no more of that kind of bin bag full of games.
Right.
And it actually, I think it makes it easier for them as well, because obviously they don't have to post the games and, you know, physical copies. But yeah, a digital key, and normally it's on Steam or a certain platform. And when you redeem it, basically all the games just appear.
Interesting. You've also lectured at university for a few years. How was that experience for you, and maybe how did it prepare you for the future roles that you then managed to secure in game design and leadership roles?
Yeah, so it's cool. So this was kind of an in-between stage after I'd finished at Ubisoft before I joined Sumo. And the only thing I didn't mention earlier was when I first joined games, it was shortly after the financial crash in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of studios that were kind of averse to taking on, you know, interns or juniors. So I was pretty fortunate kind of at that time. But if you fast forward kind of 7 years or so, when I was becoming a lecturer, you had a game design degree, which didn't necessarily have modern kind of industry experience kind of teaching those courses. But then you also had people that were coming out of the industry to basically teach, as in just not necessarily in my case, but a couple of others that I was kind of working with. So you had kind of contemporary knowledge. And then back to the kind of the financial crash side of it was, by 2015, a lot of companies, not just Ubisoft in the Northeast, were looking at how do we basically expand our talent pool, or now we're looking to physically hire, you know, tens, if not hundreds of kind of, you know, junior designers, intermediate designers. So basically, where's that talent pool going to come from? Mm-hmm. So those few things coalesced into being able to effectively revamp all of the design courses with contemporary knowledge alongside a bunch of other people that had recently joined from the industry, not just on the design side, on the art kind of side as well. And from them, the courses and the people that I'd kind of taught and the types of things that I kind of showcased to them, there are now, and this is no exaggeration, probably 36 students from those kind of courses during the time that I was there that are all over the country, probably now in kind of intermediate, senior, and in some cases lead roles. Okay. from that time. It's super cool.
Okay. That's awesome. Seeing how people progress and, you know, seeing that you're able to kind of give back as well. So it must be a great feeling.
Yeah, it was great.
Cool. And young people go then nowadays. How difficult it is for a young person to enter the industry, and from your perspective, kind of what advice would you give to people that kind of are looking to enter the games industry this year or next year?
Yes, I think it's a particularly difficult time kind of at the moment with layoffs, because mm-hmm. some companies are tending to prefer experience or, you know, higher profile kind of people in the industry, or, you know, more prominent kind of roles, only in the sense that it's less risky when they have high profile kind of bets, you know, and big investments on big projects. So they're not necessarily, you know, looking for students. At the same time, there is plenty of kind of graduate schemes out there. So that would be the first thing I say, is to look at which companies are doing the graduate schemes, how often do they do them, how many people they tend to take on. So at least there's an awareness of when that comes up, there's a preparation in advance. You know, you don't want to, tomorrow, for example, you don't want to go on Google and find out that Ubisoft is looking to take on a bunch of graduates. You should know that, generally speaking, they take them on in April and July, and therefore you should have a portfolio kind of ready for those kind of dates, or what's the type of questions that they tend to ask, you know, based on what they did last year. So that would be my first piece of advice, is just the, you know, seeking out who's doing kind of graduate schemes. And the other one I touched upon it there is a portfolio of work, because whilst you might not necessarily be on a university course anymore, or maybe some people might not have even done a university course, there is nothing to stop you just putting a website together on GoDaddy. And there's a really good site called Graphic River, where you can basically get professional level kind of websites for like £10. And it makes it look like you've, you know, paid somebody hundreds of pounds to make it for you. You can just buy a template and it looks super professional. Putting all your content kind of online, networking is a really good one. So Develop kind of Brighton is fairly expensive, but definitely achievable for a lot of people to kind of get a train down there, even if it was only for kind of one day. That's in every July. So kind of the networking kind of side of it. And then the combination of all of the above just means that you're putting yourself in the best possible place. And then even if there isn't a role available, websites like Udemy have lots of online kind of games courses for a fraction of the price of the university, for example. So even though you finished university, or you didn't go there, maybe because of the finances involved, you can definitely, you know, learn your craft from effectively online training. So there's plenty of options there. But at this particular time, it's probably more difficult than it has been in the last 3 or 4 years.
Sure. Absolutely. And yeah, I mean, you mentioned portfolio, and I always emphasize as well how important portfolio is. And even if you're looking to apply for your, you know, second or third job in the industry, even going further, you know, it just separates you from competition so much when you have a nicely designed website with, you know, stuff that you've done clearly written, you know, what you were involved with in a particular project and the achievements that you've managed to to gather and all that stuff. So it's very important.
Yeah, I've heard in the past people do things like when they used to do physical portfolios at a company, they would send them in bright orange kind of jiffy bags to make sure that, you know, somebody in the postal service kind of notices when it lands on the desk of the reception, for example. But these days, I think a really well put together website, again, that you can pay for £10, that's enough to get somebody over that kind of hurdle of showcasing your stuff and not having the person on the other end of the phone kind of, you know, trying to figure out where all your information is.
Sure. With everything that's happening in the games industry and the layoffs, and you touched upon that, like, what's your take on it? Why is this happening? Has it been, was it avoidable at all, or is it inevitable that, you know, we're going to go through this? And in your opinion, is it a cycle, or, you know, are we going to be experiencing this for a long time?
Yeah, I mean, I can only in some ways regurgitate some of the stuff I've been listening to podcasts about recently. So in the sense that exactly these kind of topics I've been listening to about, you know, what were all the factors about low interest rates and lots of people putting lots of money into games because that was better than having the money sat in the bank. You know, that seems to be at least one kind of side of it. In terms of, because you mentioned the magic word in terms of cycle, that's the only thing I would probably say from my side is when I joined games in 2010, we just had a financial crash in 2008. So that was 15 years ago, you know, 16 years ago at this point. And I've probably not seen something like we have today since then. Mm-hmm. So maybe it is a cycle, but in this case, it's taken kind of two generations to at least have a major kind of aspect on it. But also, I think the other thing that's different now is I think certainly media outlets are more interested in the development side of games more so than maybe they were 10 years ago. And especially when you see certain books that are kind of like behind the scenes, you know, what happened in game development, it seems like the public at large and, you know, the games kind of public, or at least the media, are certainly covering topics that they probably didn't cover. So I think in some ways, it's not to downplay what's kind of happening, but I think the way that it's being presented in the media is a lot different than what it was 10 years ago. And maybe we've had a mini cycle like this previously that people didn't realize had kind of happened. And then the other side of that is it's fairly normal, but, you know, not great, that at the end of a project, people will move on for various reasons. And that might be downsizing the teams. It might be somebody's worked on a game for 6 years and they've decided to kind of, you know, move on, or, you know, to try a new company. I think it's a combination of all these things kind of together that, again, I've read extensive kind of articles on this stuff, and it just seems to be that there isn't any one factor. It just seems to be a lot of things have kind of came together at once, compounded by the pandemic, you know, and lots of big budget investments during that time.
Sure. No, definitely. You're right. There's a few different reasons why it's all happening. Do you work remotely now, and have you been working remotely for a long time? And as a lead, or maybe somebody who I guess had experience leading teams during the pandemic, you know, how difficult was it, and how difficult was it to kind of adjust and adapt to all of it? And has it been different now since we're sort of back to normal, and you know, has everyone sort of gotten used to the idea? Like, what's your take on the whole kind of remote working situation?
It's interesting one, really, because when I was working at the university, we had some time that we could basically do remote work on certain afternoons, you know, maybe to catch up with some marking or maybe some preps and presentations and things like that. So you know, I'd had experience of that. And then working at Ubisoft, I was at the Newcastle studio Reflections, but I was working with teams that were in Lyon. We would have trips over to France every so often, or, you know, Malmo in Sweden every so often for the division.
Mm-hmm.
But the majority of the time, the team that you were working with were not in the same country or the same time zone. So we'd already had experience of what was effectively remote work, but in a studio kind of environment. But in terms of myself, I've been working remote for the best part of the last 3 years now, I think. And in that time, I think the people that are joining the industry, maybe in the last 2 years or so, they don't know any difference. Like, they only know remote work. They don't know what it's like in a studio kind of environment. They don't know what it's like to, you know, spin your chair around and see a programmer behind you. So it's unfortunate on that side, because I think there's certain times of the project, or, you know, especially kickoffs or certain kind of crunch talks, you know, if there's important meetings, that I definitely think benefit from being in person and the general vibe that you get from, you know, getting to know somebody. Right now, it's very easy for people to, you know, jump online for maybe their 20-minute call that they have to do every day and kind of just disappear into the ether until a feature is kind of delivered. Or, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say there's an avoidance of communication, but it does come across that way sometimes when you are having people in different time zones that are not necessarily reaching out and you have to kind of chase them up. So that's something that wouldn't happen in a studio environment. But generally speaking, the tool sets are much better than probably they were, you know, 5-10 years ago. Streaming, you know, screen recording, showing input overlays so you can, you know, show your gamepad on screen, you know, what you're actually doing, you know, if you're trying to debug something to do with the controls. The tool sets now make it just as good to kind of work from home. It's just that I think there's certain points of a project or certain kind of crunch times that, by crunch, I mean important meetings, not working overtime. There are certain kind of touchstones in the project where I definitely think it's better to be in studio, even if it's only for a short kind of time.
Yeah, definitely. Do you go to the studio at all, or you work fully remotely? Or like, how does the kind of people camp life function in general, out of interest?
Yeah, so I'm fully remote, and that's the case for, you know, a whole bunch of people I'm kind of working with. Fortunately for me, I'm in the Northeast, which is also where the studio kind of is. So the studio is less than 45 minutes drive from where I am. And it's a case of if I wanted to work there every day, I can, like, no problem. You know, we've got the snack cupboard there. We've got high fidelity PCs. You know, we've got a games library. There's people kind of dipping in and out of that studio. Mm-hmm. But there isn't a requirement to kind of go there. And also the people that are in the studio at that time, they're not necessarily on the same project as me either. So,
sure.
You know, you can overhear what's happening on different projects. And in some cases, some projects want to be a bit more secretive. But in our case, it's just a choice for the individual, basically.
Sure, understood. To finish it off, I've got the sort of question. Was there an experience during your career, or perhaps the game that you worked on, or the experience that you had, or the role that you had to undertake, that you feel really shaped you and sort of made you a designer you are today? I mean, is this something that sort of stands out for you during your career?
Yeah, if there's one, I would probably go back to my time at Ubisoft, where mm-hmm. internally, a lot of people don't know this, but you know, it's more broadly online now, but that Ubisoft internally have a design academy, or what they call a design academy, and it's effectively an offsite retreat. Well, maybe it isn't these days, but at the time it was an offsite retreat where designers come from all over the world to go to, in my case, a remote chateau in Paris in the middle of nowhere, and for a week you are completely not beholden to a project whatsoever. You are there to basically learn like stuff about game design, basically. And one of the things that's I mentioned is kind of more broadly online now is what's called rational game design. And that's an approach for how you can introduce kind of content and new mechanics into your game, make them kind of approachable, how you kind of test the player, how you showcase, you know, how to, you know, leverage the skills from the player, how you reward them, how to make it a great gun, you know, versus a kind of a good weapon, you know, how to kind of amplify the effects of all of the actions that the player does and make them feel satisfying. That whole thing is effectively like a crash course in exceptional kind of game development. I thought I was an okay designer before I went there. And I think that course just showed me how much I didn't know about game design. Okay. And I think there's a lot of people that who did that course at the same time. It was almost like a yearly cohort within the company. They would actually look forward to that, and it, you know, spread good word in terms of like the quality of designer, but also the quality of the projects. Because when you go back to your projects, you can now infuse that kind of knowledge into it. And it's something I've carried with me kind of ever since. It was a fantastic experience. And, you know, the remote chateau kind of side of it was pretty funny in the sense that you're an offsite, basically. So there's no distractions.
Sure.
There was barely any internet kind of at the time. You could only get wired internet. So if you were wireless, you couldn't just access your emails for the project. And also you with, in my case, one of the current Assassin's Creed directors, he was there with me. there's a couple of folks that are really high up in Ubisoft there with me. So you can also meet, you know, really high profile people that have basically been at the, you know, at the ship's helm of all of these big projects, and you're in a room kind of learning from them.
That sounds amazing. I hope they still do that.
Yeah, I would imagine they do. I don't know what form it's kind of sure. in. And then it's almost like the disciples have kind of fled the nest now. So that kind of knowledge is now disseminated into a lot of other companies and some online courses as well.
Sure, fair enough. Right. Well, Jamie, thank you so much. Really enjoyed the conversation. I feel like I learned a lot. So yeah, thank you so much for coming over.
Thanks for having me.
I'll be a developer this year, hopefully. So maybe we can show that then.
Perfect, yeah.
Other than that, thank you. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks again.